Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Selassie, I know. The party is in his amount. Original Luciano, Mr. Peppers, the guy, them people
Africa,
from Milan and care come and see it called Caribbean and say everything is alright. Every time them say party is in the mouth, yeah, Papa. Sing up!
Aha, Lord. Black man arrived into your land. Can't you see the time is at hand? For so long they got us down. We've made up our mind, we're going home.
Hear what a man says.
I say, 7 miles of Black Star Carolina, coming in the harbor.
Who you want, man? Say,
oh yes. I say, and anyone wants to go back to Africa, just come on over.
Come on over.
Oh
yes. Say we want to go home. Forward Africa, I feel to ride up on the Black Star Line. And me tell them, home, forward Africa, I feel to ride up on the Black Star Line. Caribbean, yes, I wear them carry I and I. Far from Africa, 1,000 or more miles. Never get to take a dip in the River Nile. Say them, come in a piece where they were so hostile. Took us from Milan, now we slave on them style. We party Asian and that we have we profile. Don't press on to be swing, I go take it with a smile. If I hope them did that press, they would have stand by them. Off we go home, forward Africa. Off we to ride up on the Black Star Line. And me tell them, home, forward Africa. Off we to ride up on the Black Star Line.
I say every man should have the right to live his own life without eyes where the black man belongs. We don't wanna be here in Babylon. No, no way. I say 7 miles of Black Star Carolina coming in the harbor. Oh yes.
What a man say.
And anyone wants to go back to Africa,
yeah, let me sing out.
Come on over. Wow, yeah, yeah.
And I say, open the gate. Time for we party, hey. Back to Africa, I mean, say no time for waste. Fire burn down Babylon, zero of flame. At a fire burn and nothing I get same. We are going to burn down Rome and then Vatican waves. Pope and all, at the fireplace, once we go home, forward Africa. Africa ride up on the Black Star Line. And me tell them, home, forward Africa. Africa ride up on the Black Star Line. And Luciana,
the might of Black Star Line.
And I say, come
in the harbor.
What a man say?
Oh, oh, oh yeah.
Hey, black brother and sister,
just come on over. Come on over.
It's
they took us away from our father's land.
It's from your
soul to Babylon.
Yeah, man.
Ashes to ashes and dust to dust.
Freedom,
black man's redemption. He's a mark.
Massive and
he's a mark. Yeah, yeah.
Tell me why we go home. Forward Africa. I'm free to ride up on the Black Star Line. I'm me tell them, home, forward Africa. I'm free to ride up on the Black.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Chef Rob Show. Tonight I have some powerful brothers on that's waiting to get in and discuss what's going on. We're just basically going to have a conversation, no real set topic, just have a conversation with everybody. And every time I try to do a show, it's about finding solutions. So remember, at the end of the show, I just want to hear solutions, not trying to go ahead and harp in on the problems. We've been having those problems for hundreds of years, but now it's time to do something about it. My first guest is Reverend Ed Pinckney of Benton Harbor. I want him to go ahead and come on in, explain the situation up there, because in every city, every county, every state, there's a Benton Harbor situation. So this is another one of those crises that we're going to have to deal with and have to confront. So Reverend Pinckney, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. How you doing today?
I'm all right, brother. How you doing?
Hey, man, I'm doing wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Just okay. Another brilliant day. That's all I can say.
Okay. I just, I don't spend a lot of time with monologues and going ahead and dragging stuff out. I like to get right into it because we got a lot of work to do. So I want you to go ahead and explain to everyone who you are and what you represent and just get straight into what's going on up there in Benton Harbor.
All right. Well, my name is Reverend Edward Pinckney. I'm the president of the NAACP here. I'm also the president of the BANCO, the Black Autonomy Network Community Organization. I'm also the president of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization. So I wear a lot of hats, and I do a lot of things, and I stay focused, keep myself busy more than anything else. And here in the city of Benton Harbor, we are fighting a real war here. This is no conflict. This is the real deal. And we have taken it upon ourselves to take this thing to a whole different level. Let me tell you a little bit about me so you know who I am. I am the first pastor in the history of mankind to ever be sent to prison for quoting the Bible. Never been done, not in modern time. There have never been another ever been sent to prison for quoting the Bible. And it seemed to me that it puts me in a different category because I got support from all over the world. And that's what I'm known for. If you ever go on the internet, they got a 500,000 articles in reference to my struggle here. But let me tell you how it all started. I'll take you up until the point of where Whirlpool here in the city of Benton Harbor, there's a hostile takeover, gentrification, trying to drive all the African Americans out, genocide, destroying families. They're doing everything they can to destroy the blacks that live in the city of Benton Harbor. I decided that I was going to attempt to try to stop them. This is what I did. We had we got 8 commissioners here who just so happen to be black and 1 black mayor. But they all are in the pockets of Whirlpool. They work for Whirlpool and not for the people. So what I did, I went out and I went out and recalled one of the head honchos, the guy who was calling the shots around here. And he was just so happened to be Whirlpool man. And it was difficult because they figured it would be no way possible for an individual or an organization with no financial backing to actually beat up on Whirlpool. Because Whirlpool was financing this whole struggle here. I shouldn't say struggle. He was they were financing the takeover of the city. So what we did, we went out and recalled one of the commissioners. And the way we did it, it was simply done by the absentee ballot. We went out and got every senior citizen. We got every person who was handicapped. We got every person who was not going to be in town for that election to vote absentee. And once, before they realized that they had lost the election, they didn't realize it until the day of the election. And that time it was too late. So Whirlpool decided they were going to do something sensational. They had to go out and find somebody who would say that I paid somebody $5 to vote, to pay somebody $5 to vote so they can start an investigation. They went out and found the young man to say that I paid him $5. They paid him $10 to say that I paid him $5. And that started the ball rolling. And I tell you, it's been something tremendous. They did everything within their power to control this, but fortunately, I had enough money to get me a paid lawyer, one of the best in the state of Michigan, matter of fact. And he did a tremendous job. We got a hung jury. The next trial, I was found guilty. All-white jury in a city that's 96% African American. And it was like something that you never believed before. I was in the middle of a real, real struggle. This is something that most people don't really realize. When you fight a power structure like Whirlpool, things like this do come about. So during the process, I found out that I did have some allies all across the country who came out and supported me during this struggle. But the thing was, that was more important than anything else, we stood up and fought. We fought Whirlpool all the way until the end. I mean, we fought them like they never have a battle, especially from black folks. And then we also had white people to come in and join us in this struggle. So we was right on top of what we was trying to do. And matter of fact, even today, I'm sitting around here just thinking about our next move against Whirlpool. But during that process, I was placed on probation after being found guilty of voter fraud. I was placed on 5 years of probation. And during that process, I write articles for the People Tribune, which comes out of Chicago. And I wrote an article, and the judge said that it was a threat on his life. Matter of fact, I quoted Deuteronomy, and it simply said, if he did not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God and do all the things that were right, all these things would come upon him. So the judge said it was a threat on his life and his family life, and they sent me to prison for 3 to 10 years. And during that process, the ACLU came in. I had another group of lawyers to come in. They all came in and fought and stood up for me. I was released after serving 3 months, 4 months really, on an appeal bond, which nobody ever gets an appeal bond, not here in the state of Michigan. Nobody gets an appeal bond once you get inside the prison system. It's all over. But I was released after that time, and the ACLU came in and fought. And at the end, the conviction was overturned. And they realized that they was barking up the wrong tree. But the thing was, if the people had not came together, I would still be in prison today. And I fought this battle from the beginning to the end. And it wasn't really about me. It was all about the people. But I tell you this, it was a true challenge. It was a true challenge. And I'm very, very comfortable with it. And on that note, Rod, if you may have some questions you might want to ask me, you go right ahead.
Oh, brother, I just want you to go ahead because I got Dr. Umar Johnson on the line. His line is open. And another powerful brother. I want everybody else to go ahead and chime in. I'm going to have my questions later on, brother.
Oh, okay, real good. So, you know, so this is what we do here. We're fighting against a Whirlpool who have came in and brought in this billion-dollar project where what they're doing, they're taking land from the blacks that live here and putting a golf course here. They call it a Jack Nicklaus signature golf course, and they're going to build condominiums around the golf course. And what we're trying to do, we have to stop just for a moment with the recall, but now what we're doing, we're trying to do something else to let them know that we're for real about what we're doing. So what we have done, we have placed ourselves in such a in a position that now we have to fight without the black commissioners and the black mayor, because they have actually sold us out completely. So we're doing things that's so incredible. But the thing that makes it so excited, these are African-American people, black people, who have actually sold their soul to the devil, to this Whirlpool Corporation, who have came in and did everything they wanted to do, taking land. They stole $500,000 worth of water from the people for this golf course. And nobody did anything about it until I said something about it. Then they said they'll pay $172,000 that they owe. And yet and still they haven't paid the $172,000 today. Then they came back and asked for a $50 million tax break from the city of Benton Harbor. And the residents didn't do it, but the commissioners agreed to give them a $50 million. And we're $5 million in the red. So we know we got some issues here that's so tremendous, but this is where people have to come together. We have to come together and fight. And what I'm trying to do more than anything else is rally these folks, make them stand up for what is right, make them stand up to do things that they never done before. And I tell you, it's been a real struggle. And people never understand what you can do until you do it. We don't have the resource, financial backing to really put down Whirlpool, but we got people resource who can do many things, and that's what we're really working on. And I tell you, I'm always excited about does anything that anytime I'm on someone's show, I just like to tell them the story so people can know. And you can always go look on the internet. You can go to my blog, which is bhbanco.org, and it tells the story itself. It tells how the fight began, and I've been fighting this fight for over 15 years, and I've been fighting it daily, every single day. I started marching, and people say, well, marching is obsolete. Well, what marching did for me, it let the people knew around the community that there was a problem inside that court system. And we start court watching. We court watch every single day. There's not a day that we don't do it. But it's all designed to try to neutralize a whirlpool because they run the court system. They run everything. They run the banks around here. Everything is ran in this community by Whirlpool. And we have to take a stand against people just like this. I have learned to stand up and fight. Anytime there's a meeting, I plan to be there. And this is what we have to do. We have to show the people that we are capable of doing things. And basically, that's what we do. And here in a community like Benton Harbor, which is 96% African-American, 96%, we got 70% of the people that live in Benton Harbor, 70% is unemployed, 90% live below the poverty level, and yet and still we giving away $50 million to a multi-billion-dollar corporation. And the reason we're giving it away, because they keep threatening to leave. My thing is that leave. Matter of fact, we'll help you pack up and get out of here. Because what you have done to this community is criminal. But the problem is the people have failed to stand up and say we're not going to take this mess no more. And my history has been right there fighting on the front line, staying on the front line, letting them know that we're for real about what we're doing. And I tell you, it's been a tremendous, tremendous battle. And I'm more than happy with how people have responded, not just here in Benton Harbor, but across the country. Any time that you can send a man to prison for quoting the Bible and nobody stands up and say it's wrong, then you got some issues. Matter of fact, which is more important than anything else, not one minister, and we have over 100 churches in Benton Harbor, not one single minister stood up and said that it was wrong. Not one minister stood up behind me and said, well, hey, I'm with you on this. Not one single minister offered a dime to help me with my finances during this crisis. So my thing is this. As a matter of fact, they was going around talking about the words that was coming out of their mouth, how much they hated my guts because I have stood up. Now, these are ministers saying this. They're saying that they were trying to say who hate Reverend Pinckney the most. He done made these white folks mad. And they was lining up. They had a meeting not to help me, but to figure out a way how to fight me with the white folks. And it was and then the thing is we dropped a bomb on them because they didn't realize that we had outside help coming in. And once we had that outside help, we neutralized them. Yeah, all the ministers, maybe about 20, 30 of them got together. And they was talking, still saying that, well, what we going to do to help Reverend Pinckney? They were saying who hated me the most. We're glad that they finally got Reverend Pinckney. He have made things hard for us here in this city. Now, these are ministers talking. These are ministers talking. And here's the bad part. They didn't just have one meeting. They had several meetings. Because some of them couldn't make one meeting, so they had another meeting to see who hated me the most. And then at the end, now here's the part that where people have, now they're coming up to me one at a time telling me that they are so sorry that they didn't come out and support me only because I won. If I would have lost this thing, they would be still talking how much they hate me. They still got a few out there who hates me who want to side with Whirlpool. See, never before in the history of mankind have you ever heard people say, especially ministers, that when I quoted the Bible, the first thing they were saying was that came out of their mouth that Pinckney got what he deserved. You know, So now what they doing now, they trying to line up behind me and trying to be my friend, knowing what they doing is wrong. I forgive these ministers, but I just hope and pray that God does. But it's
you know what? Let me ask you a question of because Brother Umar.
Yes, sir.
You heard the Reverend Pinckney story?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, in your speaking engagements across the country, how many times you come across similar situations?
Never. I've never heard of that particular situation.
Wow, really? What could you throw out as a remedy for that situation?
Well, I think one of the things that he said that was key was that black people tend to accept mistreatment from other black people, i.e.
Hold on, bro. I'm sorry, I screwed that up. I want you to introduce yourself to the people who are not familiar with you.
Sure. My name is Umar Johnson. I'm a nationally certified school psychologist, blood relative of Frederick Douglass, political scientist and educator. In my professional work, I evaluate school-aged children, and I decide who goes into special education. I'm responsible for classifying learning disabilities, mental retardation, emotional disturbances, autism, ADHD, conduct disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, and the list goes on. But basically my fight is trying to keep black boys out of special education, because special education, which is a form of miseducation, is the foundational anchor that is used to destroy and oppress black men across the lifespan. First, there is miseducation, which is the deliberate teaching to black boys of self-hatred and a simultaneous love for white people, and particularly a love for white women. And also within miseducation, you have the effeminization and deliberate homosexualization of black boys. And then that leads us to stage two, which is psychotropic medication. ADHD, conduct disorder, oppositional defiant disorder. These are disruptive behavior disorders that our young men are unfortunately labeled with when they refuse to accept differential treatment, maltreatment, miseducation, and intentional disrespect from educators within the schoolhouse, most of whom are middle-class white women. So when they do not accept the effeminization that is imposed upon them, they are now considered to have a conduct disorder. And so thusly, after that, they are then sent to discipline school, which ultimately is a segue into full-blown prison. And then once they get out of prison, they now are frustrated and isolated, which unfortunately leads to stage five, which is suicide or homicide, most likely at the hands of another black male. So those are the five stages of black male extermination, social engineering in the service of genocide, that the government, the larger society, from President Obama all the way on down to the local politician, endorses by way of neglect. And it is a fight that we have to stand up and push back against. And listening to the words, the eloquent words that the Reverend just spoke about, he's going through the same thing up there in his particular town. I know when you came on, Sheriff Rob, you had mentioned that you definitely like to talk about solutions, and so do I. But I would always caution anyone that there should be no talk about solutions until people first fully understand the problem. I'm a therapist, and when I do therapy, I cannot chart a path towards a solution. I cannot come up with a treatment plan until I first understand the history of a problem. And I only say that because I think historically black people in America and African people around the world have wasted a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of resources, and a lot of lives attacking problems that we don't understand anything about. And if I was to borrow the words of the late great psychologist Amos Wilson, he said that if you study a problem close enough, you will see the beginnings of the solution right there within their problem. The biggest challenge that we have as black people in America is misinformation. A lot of people think they understand the problem, and they don't understand it at all, because misinformation is the greatest tool used against black people. Not guns, not drugs, not jails, not violence, not white women, but misinformation, the deliberate and intentional redirecting of black people's attention away from that which they should be focused upon to that which is totally irrelevant. So we have to make sure our people have the accurate information. Most of the issues that are discussed in the black community are framed in a dichotomous way, and neither end of that dichotomy represents the true issue. For example, if we take education, any discussion on education is going to focus on there not being enough money in the schools. It's going to focus on there not being enough qualified teachers in the classroom. It's going to focus on there not being enough African-American school principals to go around the country. The problem is that particular dichotomy that I just spoke of has nothing to do with why education fails. The problem is not the fact that there's not enough qualified teachers. Okay, the problem is not the fact that there's not enough money. The problem is not the fact that there's not enough black principals to go around. The problem is the white female teacher, who is the bulk of the American teacher profession. 93% of all teachers in America are white, and all of them belong to a teachers union. And the teachers union's job is to protect the job of their teachers, whether they teach or not. And we have a situation in public education where a teacher in most cities in this country, after they have been on the job for at least 3 years, they are guaranteed to have their job for the rest of their life until they decide to retire, no matter how poorly they are. So the true reason for the educational failure of black children in general, and black boys in particular, is because teachers suffer no consequences for miseducating our children. That's number one. Number two, the teachers union has too much power, and they are able to prevent a school board from getting rid of bad teachers. In fact, I just got an email the other day. There was a brother who was a superintendent. I believe it was in upstate New York, not New York City, but in upstate New York. He is fighting for his job right now as a black male superintendent because he's trying to get rid of teachers, black and white, but mostly white, who are not teaching black children. And as a result of that, the teachers union is trying to get him fired. Nobody is investigating as to whether or not the teachers he wants to get rid of should in fact be fired. Nobody's investigating as to whether or not they have been miseducating our children, because the union doesn't care about that. The union's reputation is based on keeping teachers in their job. Public teachers are the only professionals in America where you can be poor at what you do and still cannot be forced to leave your job. They have the greatest job security in the country. No other job in America can you be shown to be poor and still keep your job until you are ready to retire. So just to wrap that up, I just want to say that misinformation works through these dichotomous problem sets that we are given. For example, if we go over to prison and you say, why are there so many black men locked up in jail? People are going to tell you, number one, okay, because they are born criminals and that they come from parents and neighborhoods where crime is totally acceptable. And then there's other people who are going to say that there's so much crime taking place because they're not given appropriate psychiatric medication. Now, psychiatric medication ain't got anything to do with the rate of crime, okay? And no black man is born a criminal in this country. But when you miseducate a black man who's public enemy number one, enemy of the state in this country, and then you prevent him the opportunity from earning a livable wage salary so he can take care of himself and his family, he has no choice but to go to the underworld. The same underworld that Jewish gangsters used to go to, the same underworld that Italian gangsters used to go to, the same underworld that Irish mobsters used to go to, is now being left for black men to go into. Crime is the creation of the society. Nobody talks about that. Nobody talks about that in any capitalist society, you must have crime because crime is an industry in and of itself. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that if it was not for crime, Wall Street would not be as successful as it is now. Nobody wants to talk about the fact if it wasn't for crime, you wouldn't have as many millionaires in America as you have now. Nobody's talking about the fact that the United States of America, the government and the society, relies upon black violence, black joblessness, and black miseducation in order for the economy to go around. How many police officers would be homeless right now if it wasn't for black crime? How many psychologists, social workers, criminologists, psychiatrists, How many halfway houses? How many prisons? How many probation officers? How many clerks? How many judges? How many attorneys would be jobless today, unable to feed their families if it wasn't for black crime? And so whenever you have crime, you have an industry of crime. And so the job of the government and the society is to protect and proliferate that industry of crime to make sure that white people can feed their families. They are literally living off the backs of black men. They did it in slavery. They did it in Reconstruction. They did it in the Civil Rights era, and they're doing it today. And the biggest problem we have, and I'm going to stop on this, the biggest accomplice to the crime of black oppression in America, okay, is the unscrupulous middle-class black leader. Some preachers, some so-called civil rights leaders, some politicians, some black business owners. These people, the well-placed college academicians, these talent-intense, elitist, snobby, bourgeoisie Negroes are the number one accomplice to the crime of black oppression. Because instead of organizing the masses of black people, like the good reverend is doing, and standing up and putting a fight against the structure, they simply stand in between the masses of black people and Obama and the government and white people, and they simply broker deals between poor black people and rich white people. In other words, when something goes wrong in the black community, the government, the structure, sends in one of these Negro leaders. They send in one of these Negro politicians. They send in one of these Negro community leaders, business leaders. They send them in, and they tell them to do what? Put out the fire. So when they come in, they don't come in to organize the black revolutionary energy. They don't come in and say, brother and sister, calm down, stop being so emotional, and let's intellectualize and strategize this issue so when we hit them where it hurts. They don't do that. They come in to tell people to go back home. Forget about what happened. Put your faith into the government. Come back in a couple months. Let the law of the land prevail, and then next thing you know, 5 years then went by and nothing has been done about the situation. So, yes, the number one enemy of black people in America is white supremacy, but the second enemy to black people in America is elitist blacks who live off of their oppression.
Wow.
Thanks, brother.
You said a mouthful.
Let me ask you a question, Reverend Ed, real quick, to feed off what Dr. Umar just said.
Okay.
Because I want to ask you, the miseducation, what Brother Umar was alluding to, that's the biggest problem up there in cities like Benton and places like Benton Harbor.
Oh, absolutely.
Explain to me miseducation that you see up there in Benton Harbor.
Well, you know, what we have here, we have six black board members, and once again, everything is controlled by Whirlpool. Whirlpool controls these middle class. These are the individuals who think they're better than the parents, even the people that voted for them. They think they're better. They won't even talk to them. They talk down to them, and usually when I come, they know that there's an issue that we need to discuss. But the thing is that's so serious about it, they care less about educating the children. The only thing is so much violence inside the city, the school system here in the city of Benton Harbor. You come to school here. Matter of fact, we only have 3,300 students in our public school system, and at one time we had almost 8,000 people. But they're leaving. They're going to the outside because for the simple reason. We have brought it to their attention that you have to start educating the kids. You have to make it a safe haven for the kids. It's not about you. It's all about the future of our children. And you got to start educating them, unless we're going to file a suit in your court, in federal court. And we've been contemplating, you know, when we're going to do it. But we're going to do it to show them, and these are black folks, oh, you got to give us a chance to fix the problem. How much longer do we have to give you to fix the problem? Educate our children. That's all we ask you to do. And it's not about money, just like you said. It's not about money. You see, it's all about whether you're willing to do the right thing. Educate my children. Teach them. Take them to a level that they've never been on. Look, we got an all-black city commission. We got almost an all-black board. Yet and still, we're suffering on all angles. It doesn't make any sense to me. Do you know how many people died to put us in a position that we're in today? Can you realize that? And we got these Negroes, these are real Negroes, that what they're doing is still pushing us down. They probably consider themselves house Negroes. You know, you got field Negroes and you got the house Negroes. If you are on the board, that means that you're a house Negro. If you are a commissioner, that means you're a house Negro. But if you're not in one of those two positions, you're a field Negro, and they look down on you. Why should we educate your children if we don't have to? Why should we educate your children if you don't force us to do it? It's on you. And also, let me say this. When we had that uprising in 2003, Jesse Jackson came here. He came here not for the people. He came here for Whirlpool. Whirlpool summoned him here to calm us down.
Hold on, brother. I want you to explain to the people out there what happened in 2003.
In 2003, we had a young man. His name was T-Shirt. He was riding his motorcycle, and the police began to chase him. And, you know, most likely, 9 out of 10 times, a car is not going to catch a motorcycle. Because he know how to bob and weave through the streets. But what they did, they cut him off. And this police car hit the back of the motorcycle and sent the young man through this front porch window. And he died instantly. The cops pulled him out of the house, laid him on the sidewalk, and started giving each other high fives. Because he was dead. And folks saw this. So now they're mad. The next day they had a vigil for this young man. They did not want, the police now, did not want the residents of Benton Harbor to have a vigil for this man. So what they did, they called in the troops to try to curtail this vigil that was about to happen. Right in the middle of the process, they started beating up on people, and that started the uprising in 2003. And then they called in the army. They had tanks. They had those machine guns on the back of the Jeep. They had the whole works. During that process, Whirlpool summoned Jesse to come down here and end this madness in their eyesight. Every single night for 4 or 5 days, there was nothing. But, you know, street fighting, they were throwing bottles. They didn't have any guns or anything like that. But they were throwing bottles and different things. So Jesse comes in. Rather than meeting with the people, he met with Whirlpool. He sat down at the table with them. Somebody said that they gave him $40,000. Somebody said, you know, he gave him $50,000. You know, you hear all these rumors. We wasn't there, so we don't know what they gave him. And I'm not going to sit here and say they gave him anything because I don't have any evidence to support it. But I will say this. He did not come down here to meet with us. He met with them.
That's the same thing Brother Umar was just talking about.
Oh, absolutely. What he was saying was fit right into where we're going with this. Because he had an opportunity to come down here and say, hey, let's organize. See, that's the key word. And he was in a position to organize the people here because they would have, for Jesse Jackson to come here, these folks would have been going mad. They would have did anything he asked them to do. Anything. If they say march, if he say march, they march. If he say run, they going to run. If he say fight, they going to fight. That's where it was. But he came down here to neutralize the people here in the city of Benton Harbor. And here's the deal. The only way that our organization got a chance to meet with them, they was having a meeting with the white folks at one of our centers, and we walked in. Other than that, we would have never been able to sit down at the table with them. And they didn't want to hear what we had to say either. Matter of fact, one of the brothers got indignant. He had to rise up acting like he's going to do something physically to them. So that's the only way. But that's where we talk about when you were talking about people coming in and how they do things. This was a perfect example of what you were saying in reference to that. also the miseducation. He knew that we had an educational problem here with people being miseducated. But what we want to do now, we have to force these folks to the table. And I hate to hear people talking about, "You, we don't have the money to do this," or "we don't have the money to educate your children." I don't want to hear that, because it don't always take money. And that's what they don't realize. But we living in a
you
time
know what?
Now
me,
where we have
the,
to take, go ahead.
Let me ask Dr. Umar something. Do we need money, Dr. Umar Johnson?
For schools, no. You have to understand that the education budget, although smaller than the prison budget in most states, is still higher than most other allocations. Another reason why we have to be careful about the way we allow arguments in educational finance to be framed is because people who pimp and exploit and manipulate educational budgets for personal profit love to hear parents. They love to hear black people say, "We need more money." And the reason they love to hear black people say that the schools need more money is because 75% of most school budgets go directly to personnel expenditure. That means that 75 cents of every dollar is going towards somebody's salary. It does not go into the classroom to help the children. Let me give you an example. Here in Philadelphia, when the state or the federal government sends the School District of Philadelphia a $10 million grant, $7 million of that grant money is going to hire more white people so they can take care of their families. The money rarely ever goes into the classroom. The money rarely ever goes to improve the school building that the kids live in. The money rarely ever goes to be used to purchase more school books. The money is used to hire more white people. It is used to give vendors who have contracts with the district, who don't care anything about our children, the opportunity to get a higher contract offer. It is a pimp game, which is why black people have to stop coming to the table, joining these white liberal educational think tanks, fighting for more money. Of course, you can always use more, but we have to recognize that we come from a legacy of people who educated themselves and their children with less. Take my ancestor, Frederick Douglass, who taught himself how to read. He didn't have a white teacher. He didn't have a school. He didn't even have a black teacher, and it was no special education. But yet he was able to learn the language and speak it and write it better than any person to ever walk on American soil. So as you can see, it is crystal clear that money is not the issue, but they want us to argue about the money, because if we frame educational failure around money, then that gives white capitalists and black capitalists the opportunity to pimp that money for personal profit, which is one of the reasons why most school board appropriation graphs are not available for public viewing. The average school district does not allow the taxpaying citizen to look at the books and see exactly who is getting contracted with through the school district. It's one of the biggest secrets in most cities. When pimping is to be done, there is no industry better to pimp than the schools. So forget about the money. It's about controlling the teachers. It's about controlling the curriculum, and it's about making sure you have firing power over anyone who fails to educate their children. But even on top of that, gentlemen, we have to make sure that we prevent the homosexual and lesbian onslaught that's currently taking place in our public schools, that's teaching elementary school black boys and girls that they should be having sex with people of the same gender. Now, most of us would agree, and I'm a psychologist. psychologist who specializes in child development, and I can tell you that the elementary school classroom is not the appropriate place, nor are those children at the appropriate point in the intellectual development to be taught about sexual intimacy with another human being, more or less homosexuality and lesbianism. But that's what's being pushed right now, and it's being pushed through your president, and nobody black wants to talk about it, that President Obama has personally appointed more homosexuals and lesbians to federal positions in the United States government more than any president in United States history and more than George Bush and Bill Clinton put together. And the reason black people don't want to talk about the homosexual wars that we are having is because Obama and other elitist blacks have convinced us to believe that if we are going to be against homosexuality, we are somehow civil rights hypocrites, because after all, we were a marginalized population of people who a lot of folks thought shouldn't be integrated, and we're still not, but nonetheless, they have confused black people and made them think that you have to be for a certain sexual lifestyle if you want to consider yourself a minority. And so many black people are jumping behind the homosexual bandwagon and pushing it on because they think it makes them look bad if they don't accept gay and lesbian behavior. Now, I'll be the first one to tell you that I don't believe that we should reject, mistreat, or harm any African person, regardless of their mental illness. And yes, to me, homosexuality and lesbianism is still a mental illness. But those individuals should not be mistreated. But at the same time, I can still uphold your humanity and disagree with your behavior. Just like when a brother kills or when a brother steals, I can still uphold his humanity and disagree with his behavior. But Obama and the Obama maniacs and the elitist blacks have convinced black people that in order for you to really be for civil rights, that you also have to be for homosexual rights. And nobody has yet to answer the question, what in the hell does your decision to have sex with somebody has to do with my God-given identity as an African, which I came into this world with when my mother pushed me out of her womb? Who you have sex with and who you are two totally different things. But the Obama maniacs have successfully convinced most of the black community to believe that if you're going to be for black people, then you also have to be for homosexual behavior.
I have a couple of callers. 312-841. Your line is open. State your name, where you're coming from. 312-814. Brother Ricky, you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here, brother.
I'm gonna leave your line open.
Yeah, how are you?
How you doing, brother? Go ahead and let everybody know who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I'm Brother Ricky Brown. I'm with Planet Africa, which is a promotion and product printing company, and I'm the chairman of the Westside Historical Society. You know, I was just mesmerized by the conversation, especially hearing both of your guests. It's reminiscent of, you know, I just have to be perfectly honest with you about this. Here it is, we have a direct descendant of Frederick Douglass, who is talking like Carter G. Woodson, and the conversation sounds reminiscent of Booker T. Washington. It's like 1933 and 1901 rolled up in one big conversation, because with Carter G. Woodson, he talked about the miseducation of the Negro, and this is exactly what I'm hearing your guests talk about, and it's really a shame, because I hear how we continue to allow the Willie Lynch-ism to go on within our community, segregation being the worst thing that could have ever happened to the African-American community, because it began to, I mean, integration rather, due to the fact on how our people began to turn around and feel that they just couldn't wait to get down to Sears and Roebuck you know, to no longer shop in our own communities. The doctors left, the teachers left, or what have you. And then I have to agree with you, brother, about the issue dealing with having to accept homosexuality because they have taken the flag and the banner of the civil rights movement and made it their own. You know, it's really something else. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I'm going to sit back and listen some more, and once I get a chance, I can let you and your audience hear of the event that we're planning to have this June 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, we're gonna get
in. Yeah,
we're gonna get into that. We're gonna get in. I've been posting links for it, so I want everybody to check it out. I'll put it up again. But I got another caller here. Just stay with us. You're gonna stay with us, right?
Yes, I will.
Okay. 347-289, your line is open. State your name, where you calling from?
Black Power, Black Power. My name is Seville. You know, I'm calling out of Brooklyn, New York. You know what I'm saying? I'm listening to both brothers. You know, I'm really familiar with, you know, with Omar, because me and Omar are getting ready to do an all-women summit in Brooklyn, New York, coming up February the 5th. Where we
okay,
will
explain. Go ahead and let everybody know about the event.
All right. We have an event February the 5th. We will be addressing, you know what I'm saying, you know, the psychological warfare that has been put on our women. We will show them and demonstrate to them, man, how they're thinking and the way they look at a relationship, you know, with the other half, how it has been distorted. It has been, you know, delusionized. It has been, you know, changed up. We are going to show them, man, how to look at things in the proper manner. We're going to show them also, man, how men view them, how men look at them, you know what I'm saying, and have no respect for them because they don't respect themselves. You know, it's going to be a powerful affair. You know, I have a whole lot of women that's coming from all over the country. And I think that is very important because, see, the woman is the one in the household with our children. And if she's miseducated, if she has the proper knowledge, if she doesn't have the proper insight on how to deal with these babies inside this household, then the whole black race is doomed. So I think at this proper time, it is time for us to attack this situation and to show these sisters how valuable they are, show them how strong they are, and also try to bring them back to who they're supposed to be. And I think that me and Brother Omar, man, will, you know, definitely succeed in this task, but it has to be called now, and it has to happen now because, you know, we are, you know, in a real messed up situation in this so-called country that we live in called America, man. And I think that it's time for us to really attack this situation, first the women, and then maybe after that, man, the men.
Thanks, Brother Seville. You have a question?
Well, you know, I have a question. You know, I'm going to say this. I think at the end of the day, you know, for anybody to be successful in America, I think we have to put aside all of these different concepts and belief systems and deal with black issues. I think it's too much set on us having, you know, all of these different, you know, organizations or different belief systems that we are dealing with, and it's taking the idea of the strength off the actual thing that we need to address, and that's the black issue, man, you know, say, in our communities, man. It's killing, this homo, you know, phase that's going on, you know what I'm saying, the miseducation of our children, you know what I'm saying, you know, there's so many issues that we need to deal with, and we have this religion system, be it Islam, Christianity, the more science, I mean, all of these different entities, man, won't sit down because we are dealing with different belief systems, because you don't believe without, I don't believe, you don't want to sit down and really discuss black issues, you know, and I think that that has to be addressed, and until we address this situation, I think we're going to have, you know, a hard time at it. But I would like Brother Omar, man, to, you know, elaborate on what I just said.
Good looking out, too, Brother Seville. Reiterate what he said as it relates to the ideologies. As you all know, in the black community, we have all sorts of paradigms of thought. Some of us are Pan-Africanists, such as myself. I will fall into that camp. We have brothers who are Hebrew Israelites, Moors, integrationists, religious nationalists. We have brothers and sisters who follow certain African traditions. We have all kinds of ideology. The problem is that everybody is focused upon convincing people to believe in their particular way of thought. And the problem with that is it does not necessarily equal progress for the race. For example, everybody, regardless of ideology, needs to be able to eat. They need to be able to have shelter. They need to be able to have clothing, good health care, a decent job. These things supersede ideology. So if we know that regardless of how we think, regardless of what we call God or how we worship God, okay, we understand that there's certain things that people need to have a decent quality of life, then rather than fighting over whose particular religion or political ideologies is most exact, we should be coming together in unity to provide our people with the needs. Because at the end of the day, a hungry person is going to go and listen to the person who has food to offer him. At the end of the day, a mother who cannot take care of her children is going to listen to the ideology or the religious doctrine of those who are able to help her look out for her youth. So at the end of the day, if you really want the people to come your particular way, then you have to do the work. But unfortunately, the so-called conscious and revolutionary community has been reduced to a bunch of ideologues who do nothing but run around talking, bragging, and trying to convince everybody that the way that they think is correct and everybody else is incorrect. And for that, I always like to highlight the 19th century accomplishments of African people in America. When you look at the 19th century, from 1801 to 1889, it was the most progressive century for black people in America. The irony of the 19th century is that we were still in slavery for most of it, not coming out until 1865, and I want to say legal slavery, not true slavery, which still goes on right now. But when you look from 1801 to 1899, black folk got out of slavery. Black folk started some of the most progressive organizations, some of the most progressive churches, some of the most progressive businesses. They stood up and fought with the Ku Klux Klan. They stood up and fought governments. They marched their way into certain houses of legislature and demanded their rights. Black people were killed, but black people also made progress. Our first newspapers come out of that. Our first Pan-Africanist organizations come out of that. The Haitian Revolution comes out of that. When you look at the 19th century, you have the most progressive period for black folks. But again, the irony is back then we wasn't Hebrews and we wasn't Garveyites. Back then we wasn't Moors and we wasn't this and we wasn't that. We were just black people who had enough common sense to know that we were in trouble, and if we didn't do something about it, we wouldn't be around for a long time. Back then we had common sense. We had common sense. Today we got a whole bunch of ideology, but with no common sense, and that's why we've been going back to the future ever since then.
Brother Omar, let me ask you a question. What do you think is more important, love or unity?
Well, in order to have unity, you got to have love. Love is a prerequisite for unity. And the reason you got to have love in order to have unity is because in the process of unity formation, individuals within that collective are going to disagree, and emotions are going to fly high. And without the love, you won't be able to bring them all back together again. That is why when black people come together, we tend to stay together for about 3 months or 3 years, and then the organization or the initiative or the effort dies. The only time the organization or the initiative or the effort does not die is when there's some sort of financial stake within it, meaning that the employees are paid, or there's enough money coming into the organization where people are not going to leave, because then there is a financial loss associated with that. But if we're talking about voluntary struggle, which is what we're going to have to do to get out of the situation, because we can't expect to get paid to save ourselves. Harriet Tubman wasn't looking for a check. Marcus Garvey wasn't looking for a check. Frederick Douglass wasn't looking for a check. So we shouldn't be looking for a check. But the issue is we don't have enough love. And because we don't have enough love, you can't have self-hate and self-love at the same time. Those emotions are totally opposite.
one another. So either there is self-love or there is self-hate. And unfortunately, because we as African people still suffer the psychological ramifications of chattel enslavement, most of us are still infected with the disease of self-hate. But we think we love ourselves because we got dreadlocks. We think we love ourselves because we read some books. We think we love ourselves because we took 20 trips to Egypt. We think we love ourselves because we can speak a certain African language. But none of that stuff has anything to do with the mindset or the psychological state. The only way you can undo psychological conditioning is to redo psychological conditioning. And black people have never had a period of therapy after the end of slavery to undo the menticide and to put back into us that which was stripped. And until we do that, brothers and sisters, it will be difficult for us to get anywhere, because the minute something goes wrong in a black effort, a black initiative, or a black organization, black people get mad at each other, and we've all seen this, and they will destroy that organization. And we are filled with so much self-hate that rather than walk away because we no longer feel like we want to be a part, we can't just walk away. That would be too peaceful. We got to destroy the group. We got to create cliques. We got to make people walk out with us. And that's why nothing ever works, because everybody comes in the room screaming black power and everybody walks out filled with black hatred. Post-traumatic slavery disorder. And the reason why we can't solve it is because most of us don't want to admit that we are still infected with the disease of the slave master.
Come in.
Well, here's what I say. That's tremendous. I tell you, I am so happy tonight to be on the line with you, Omar. I think you are tremendous, and nothing but respect for you, because you laid it on the line. You didn't hold back. You told it like it was, or like it is, as we say. And you've been tremendous, and you have really given me an education. Even though, regardless what I have done or what I have been through, I tell you this, you know, I'm excited. As a matter of fact, I'm excited to even meet someone like you, you know, because I love people to tell it just like it is. I don't want you to hold back. I mean, if there's an issue within myself, I like for someone to tell me about me. But Reverend, you're not doing that right, or you have crossed that line, or something that would make me be a better person to help other people. I can't help you if I'm not right. You see, if there's something wrong within my system, I can't help you. And I want to be as good a person as I can be to help my community and help the people here. That's my black brothers and sisters.
There you go. Let me ask you a quick question. We're going to go back up a little bit. Reverend Ed, in the situation up there in Benton Harbor, has the new governor been helping you at all, or assisting you?
No,
any kind
Snyder
of way?
We're living in Republican country. And in my eyesight, the Republican and Democrat, they're the same people. You know, it's the same system. We got to deal with that system rather than deal with each other. We had a Democratic governor who came down here and gave the people in Benton Harbor a song, and we danced like we was crazy, like we was house Negroes. We danced. Whatever she said she wanted done, we did. If she said clean the streets, we cleaned the streets. Whatever she said to do, and everybody was just so happy that the governor came to the city of Benton Harbor. I mean, they were so happy. The governor is coming. She'll let you know 2-3 days ahead of time that she's coming. And everybody, all the black folks just be lying there waiting to meet her. And I tell you, it was something that, you know, that you would say, that's all you can say in reference to it, because it was just that bad. But one of the things that we have learned, we learned to utilize the people here to build up a resistance of her. That's what separated us from any other time. People begin to realize now that she's not who she says she was. She's not really here to help us. And that's where we had the edge. But basically, Governor Snyder, he's not going to help us. but we need to help ourselves. We shouldn't have to worry about allowing him to help us. We need to start helping ourselves and don't worry about waiting for somebody to come in to save us. We don't need people to save us. We need to save ourselves. And
right.
I think that's what it's all about.
Okay. All right, thanks for that, man. Let me take some calls here because I got a lot of people on the line here. 315-427. Your line is open. State your name, where you're calling from. A question or comment? Okay. I come back to you. 267. 970. 267-970. Line is open. State your name, where you're calling from. You have a question or comment? Okay, I'm going to go down the line here. One of the things that I see is that this is just like, you know, I'm glad you brothers are on the line. It's because we see that, hey, look, even in a small town like Benton Harbor, Michigan, what's the population there, Reverend Ed, before I go further?
It's 11,000, about 800, and I would say 95, or you can round it off to 11,900. And 96% of them are African Americans. That's the thing. That's the killer part. Like, this is the part that hurt me more than anything else. We got an all-black government who caters to white folks. That destroys me. An all-black government who caters to white folks care less about the future of our children. See, that's the killer part. We can have anything. We are surrounded by water. You know, everybody want to come here. People from Chicago want to come here. You know, I was born and raised in Chicago. I know. But the people here, this is a whole different world. And who would believe in a lifetime that someone would send a preacher, a pastor, to prison for quoting the Bible? There's no place. This is they're still hanging nooses here. They're still burning crosses here. They had the Klans to come here. We done had it all right here. But the point is, it's going to continue until the people take a stand. You see, if we don't take a stand, it's going to continue. And it's going to go all across the country. Now, these folks, they for real about what we're doing. But we have to show them that we are capable of doing things. And I believe this. I believe this. There's nothing too hard for us if we put our mind to it and come together.
Exactly. 651-470. Your line is open. State your name, where you're calling from. Okay. Let me see if I can get a few more calls. There's a lot of people on the line. 347-435. The line is open. State your name, where you're calling from. All right, let me take someone else. They popped their hand, popped up. Not a good thing. 718-790. Your line is open. State your name, where you're calling from.
Peace and blessings. This is Sean from Queens, New York.
Hey, how you doing? You have a question or comment?
I just wanted to make a comment and thank Brother Umar. I've been listening to him for a while. And he always, Brother Umar always says something new that I always learn. And he's definitely an example. He said his father was a drill sergeant. And Brother Umar, you know, every time I look, he's always on a blog talk radio show, or he's always traveling, you know, sometimes by himself, a lot of times by himself, you know, because he's dedicated and he really wants to see the upliftment of our people, and he really loves our people. I can genuinely say that myself because I've seen him, you know, move in and out of New York and Philly and everywhere else. I just want to say to the people listening out there, you know, for the people that know the information and want unity and really love our people, we just got to start networking a little bit more. You know, if you see somebody and they talk about the problems of our people and they want to do something, take their number. Take their number down and start building, you know, a type of relationship with them, man, because, you know, sometimes it's hard out here when you see white supremacy and you're talking to somebody who's, you know, totally clueless of what's going on, and they start looking at you like you're crazy, you know. I was earlier this morning, I was looking at a DVD Frances Cress Welsing. She came to New York last month, and she just broke it down so beautifully, because sometimes, you know, trying to reach people, your voice just automatically, you know, aggression just automatically comes out. You know, when you know what this European has done to us and continue to do to us, and, you know, sometimes you want to do anything for your people at the time, you know, but she was just saying, like, you know, we through the black man's, you know, testicles, we could eliminate their race, you know, so they're very fearful of that. But at the same time, that's no excuse to go and try to kill off a whole population of black people, you know what I mean? And they are our children, but they sick, though, you know what I mean? Our people sick, too. But I do believe that we have the people out there to really run the nation and really turn this thing upside down within a few years. We don't need no 100 years, no 20 years or anything like that. The people is out here. We just have to network and give them, you know, hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Are we still here?
Oh, okay. We just got to network and, you know, just, you know, let them know a little bit about their history, because it's definitely, you know, we... the media is just straight up dominating our people's minds. You know, the schools.
The media is doing a bad on us. The media is doing a bad job on us. I agree. We need to go ahead and also have our own black media. But there are a lot of people out here trying to go ahead and do things as far as the black media is concerned, and we're not supporting some of these brothers and sisters. It's a lot of people out here trying to do stuff like Scotty with his black talk with his black radio network. He's trying to do something, and there's a lot of other brothers and sisters out here trying to do something. I agree. I want to go ahead and ask Dr. Umar, how would he feel about your comments?
Oh, well, I agree with the brother, Sean. You know, he's on point. That's my brother. We're good friends. One thing I want to say, though, and I want to be very clear about this for everyone, because sometimes we don't like to deal with the truth as black people. And one of the biggest problems we have is that we do not spend most of our time in reality. The average black person spends most of their time in a dreamland that I call Negro land. See, in Negro land, the white people treat you the way you want to be treated. In Negro land, your children can receive a decent education. In Negro land, you elect a politician and they do what they're supposed to do right by you. But see, Negro land is an imaginary place that does not exist. We have to make sure we keep both feet on the ground and our minds set on the consciousness of the here and now. And one thing we have to understand about our existence in America is this, and it's a shocking fact that a lot of us don't like to understand. We can build. Yes, we can build. But we will never be allowed to build past a point that begins to threaten the power structure's control over us or our African brothers and sisters scattered throughout the world. And this is something that black folk in America don't get. We think that we're going to be able to stay here, build up an independent government or an independent media or an independent industry or an independent church or an independent school system that rivals or threatens the predominance of the European equivalent and think that we're still going to be around. Most of us who've studied our history understand that there was a place called Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Charleston, South Carolina, and Rosewood, Florida, and dozens of other cities where the black industry superseded that of the European. And so the European set out with the support of the local, state, and federal government to destroy the black success and to put Negroes back in their place. I'm only saying that to say this, that we cannot exist outside of Africa without Africa's backing and Africa's support. I didn't say that we had to go back to Africa. I did not say that. Mr. Garvey never said that. But I'm saying that we're going to have to contribute to the uplift of strong, independent African nation states who will be able to back us in any economic, political, industrial, educational, or spiritual undertaking that we embark upon. Why? Because without the backing of an independent state, we will never be able to realize success outside of the continent,
because any threat we pose to the existing European social order will be eliminated. So if we think we're going to do this without Africa, we can forget it. To say it another way, black people in America are doomed if we do not begin to embrace operational pan-African unity, if we do not begin to link up operationally with our brothers and sisters in the Caribbean, our brothers and sisters in Europe, our brothers and sisters in Asia, our brothers and sisters in Central, South America, and, of course, on the mother continent of Africa. As Marcus Garvey said, the future of black people without Africa spells doom and destruction. Yes, we can stay here, but you will not be here for long if you also do not make Africa what it needs to be so you can be what you have to be.
There you go. You ready to take another call? RBG, the line is open.
Can you hear me?
I got you.
All right.
Question or comment?
Yeah, I got a
black
comment.
Black power, brother.
Black power to you. This is God Zulu. You know,
God Zulu.
Yeah, I'm really humbled right now, and Dr. Johnson, you took my thunder because you answered the question I was going to ask before I got a chance to ask it. So now I'm scrambling, trying to see if I can come up with something else real quick. But I think it's important that I go ahead and admit that I suffer from traumatic slave disorder, and I oftentimes find myself slipping in and out of Negro land. You know, and it's hard, but I think that a lot of us find that struggle to be something that is very easy to deal with, and at the same time, very convenient to pretend that it does not exist. You know, so I really commend you, brother. I commend all you brothers for everything that you're doing, and I heard Brother Seville speak earlier about you and him, Dr. Johnson, putting together something for the sisters. And that is something that I think is paramount in our community, something that needs to be done quickly. And that is reaching out to that part of our people that is pretty much in every fabric of society. You know, I think I heard Supernova Slum mention it in one of his videos that the reason why the sisters are important to reach these days is because they are a part of our community that is ingrained in every fabric of society that we live in right now. They are everywhere. They are all the way up to the top parts of politics and all the way ingrained into law enforcement, education, you name it. They're there. And I think it is really important that we reach our sisters and let them know that they are as important as they would like to think that they are, or like they feel like maybe we've dropped the ball and letting them know that they are. But a question I want to ask you also, Dr. Johnson, I'm going to take some thunder from Sister Nina. I read that you were coming to Atlanta in February. If you would, could you elaborate a little bit more on what you brothers plan on saying for the sisters and where you might be when you come to Atlanta?
Yes, indeed, and thank you for that comment. As Brother Sean and Brother Seville alluded to earlier, on Saturday, February the 5th, which is the first Saturday in Black History Month, Saturday, February the 5th, at the Brownsville Recreation Center in Brooklyn, New York, which is located at 1555 Linden Boulevard, L-I-N-D-E-N, 1555 Linden Boulevard, at 3 o'clock on Saturday, February the 5th, we're going to be hosting a free seminar for black women entitled For Relationships and Dating. For sisters only, Relationships and Dating, What Tyler Perry's Movies and Steve Harvey's Books Got Wrong. And we're not doing the seminar to attack either one of those brothers, but because of the movies and the book, I think that a lot of our sisters have gotten an oversimplification of the relationship problems that black men tend to bring to the table and that black women tend to bring to the table. So what I want to do as a psychologist is to expound upon the issues that arise within the course of black male-female relationships, taking a historical view, coming up from slavery, taking a cultural view, what we were like before then, but also taking a psychological view based on how we have been mentally engineered to self-destruct and destroy each other in our own relationships. So there's also going to be a follow-up for brothers-only relationships and dating. And Brother Seville and I, Sean, Mark, LaRon, we're going to get together and come up with that as well. But this first one is going to be for the women only. And I want to make this clear, and I'm not being sarcastic, because this was a question that was posed to me on my Facebook wall. Is it acceptable for homosexuals and transgendered men, those who have had sexual surgery, to come to the event? This is an event for black women who came out of their mothers as black women, not no one who's trying to be a woman or no one who has had a sex change. And I'm only saying that because I have been asked on Facebook if it was okay. That's how sick we've gotten in the black community. But that's what's going to take place on February 5th. If anybody wants the flyer, you can email me, UmarAbdullahJohnson@yahoo.com. I'm also on Facebook. You can also get me on blackexperts.com, blackspeakers.com. And, of course, my phone number is area code 215-989-9858. Also, I will be in Chicago. I will be on Chicago on Tuesday, February the 8th at 9 p.m., Channel 19 Public Access. Part two with Brother Dawah Yisrael, The Psychoacademic War Against Black Boys, part two. We did part one this past fall, but I'll be back on Tuesday, February the 8th, 9 p.m., Channel 19 Public Access. So I want all my Chicago family to tune into that. I'll be in Atlanta on the weekend of February the 24th through the 26th. I will be building with Sister Zuri, who's down in Atlanta. She's having a Pan-African Educational Summit, which is going to be powerful. I'm still going to get information from her and also post that on my Facebook for individuals who want to come out. But we're going to talk about a lot of serious topics as it relates to educating ourselves about Pan-Africanism, but also building up independent African institutions, not just in America, but on the continent as well. But Sister Zuri is going to be heading that up. I'll be in Columbus, Ohio, February 11th through the 13th. I'll be at Michigan State University up in Lansing, Michigan, home of Malcolm X, doing post-traumatic slavery disorder, incarceration of the Negro mind. That's going to be put on by the Black Student Alliance, as well as my good brother Paul Allen Billings out of Muskegon, Michigan. I'll be in West Palm Beach, Florida, February the 16th to the 22nd, speaking for the Marcus Garvey Community Center effort down there. I'll be the keynote speaker for a banquet to raise money for the Marcus Garvey Center that they're building down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And then I will end Black History Month in Jamaica for the first time, February the 20th to 8th to March the 7th. I will be with the Bobo Ashanti House of the Rastafari for their Ethiopian African Black International Congress week-long celebration. Shout out to Brother Benton. Shout out to Brother Moambe and all my Bobo Ashanti Rastafari. So that's what I'm going to be doing for Black History Month.
Beautiful.
Thank you, brother. Let's go around and go ahead and introduce Reverend Ed, you still there?
Oh yeah, I'm here. Hey, I heard you mention Paul Billings. He's also a very good friend of mine. What day are you going to be at Michigan State?
I'll be at Michigan State the day before I fly to Atlanta, so that will be Wednesday, February the 23rd.
Okay, I'm going to try to be there. I would love for you to send me an email, let me know the location and the time, and I, me and my wife, and maybe bring a few folks up there. Let me give you my
Reverend Ed, I want you to give your contact information and what you do up there in Benton Harbor, since we haven't heard in a minute. Go ahead, let everybody know.
Hey, the doctor is giving me an education, and I appreciate it. See, I can spread this the word even better now because
I'm giving you my information.
Okay, you can reach me at BANCO9342@sbcglobal.net. That's BANCO 650-942 at sbcglobal.net, or you can call me at 269-925-0001. That's 269-925-0001.
Okay, thanks. All right, hold on a minute. Brother Ricky Brown, you still online?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Brother, I want to, I've been throwing it in the chat, you know, the link to what we plan to do this summer. So I want you to go ahead and let everybody know, because I'd like for these two brothers and everybody on the line, everybody listening, to go ahead and come to this Juneteenth festival we got going on here in Chicago. So, Brother Ricky, let everybody know what's happening.
Well, on Juneteenth, June 16th.
You are the chairman also, okay? I forgot to mention that.
You said what?
I said, let everybody know that you're the chairman of what's going on this summer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm the chairman of the West Side Historical Society. My name is Ricky Brown. This summer, June 16th through the 21st, we're having a Juneteenth festival, five-day festival. Going to be free to the general public. We have 300 vendor spaces available from food, merchant, and information. We'll have a carnival, fireworks, three large stages of entertainment. Going to be a very nice event. This is the fifth year that we put on this. We're expecting 10,000 to 15,000 people a day. If people want more information, they can go to our website, which is www.juneteenth2011.com. Again, that is juneteenth2011.com. And we ask for your support. We're looking for the community to come out and assist in the planning for the event. We meet every Saturday at 1 p.m. over at the Garfield Park Golden Dome, which is 100 North Central Park, right off of Washington and Central Park. Again, that's 100 North Central Park, right off of Washington there. And it's every Saturday at 1 p.m. And we would like
okay.
for, yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, no, go ahead. I was just going to agree with you because I want to make sure that everybody go ahead and be there, you know. Dr. Umar and Reverend
Yes,
Ed,
sir. Yes,
and,
sir. Just tell me what day. All I need to know, I'm going to be in touch with the elder, but just let me know what day. I'm coming up to volunteer my services to present and make the Juneteenth celebration up there in Chicago a great success. I just want to know when y'all sticking me in. I can do several workshops, a whole conference, however y'all want to do it, presentations for the children, for the parents, for the community, however y'all need me. But I'm volunteering my services, so just let me know where you're sticking me in at, and I'll be there.
Okay, well, what we'll do with that commitment, we'll make sure we get a tent set up where folks can come and do workshops with you. Plus, we would love to have you on stage to give some of that powerful information that you've been giving. Reverend, we would love to have you there and our brothers and sisters in Benton Harbor, Michigan. We look for to make this a national and international event. So if you're listening in whatever part of the country, here in Chicago, we have Congressman Danny K. Davis, who is the national chair of Juneteenth, and we would like to let it be known to him that this is something that we want to have continuously every year to bring a consciousness to the west side of Chicago. And also, what made us decide to do this is I became a little, not discouraged, but saddened to see every year the Puerto Rican flag, the Polish flag, the Ukrainian flag, the Mexican flag on cars, sticking out of windows with great pride, knowing that here it is, Marcus Garvey had gave us the flag that
That's right.
gave us great pride. And no, Marcus said that if show me a nation without a flag, I'll
That's
show
right.
you a people without pride. And
That's right.
it's really something else, you know, to have, you know, been the architects of civilization. And now we have our young warriors who it is innate in to turn around and be warriors out here killing each other. So we wanted to do something not to throw a party, but to show the great contribution that we as an African here in America has contributed to the building of this country. You know, the 400 slaves building the house that Obama lives in right now. You know, our people need to know our great contributions, and the diaspora needs to know that we have populated the entire earth. So we really would love to have you all to come out and, again, go to the website, www.Juneteenth2011.com. Sound like I'm doing a commercial, but I'm really trying to push this to bring this consciousness.
Push it.
African people of the diaspora, and especially black folks here in the city of Chicago, on the west side of Chicago.
I would like to make a statement, right? This is Bill speaking. I wanted it to be noted that, you know, Umar is not by himself. Soon he will be moving around the country, you know what I'm saying, with a force and power. I just wanted it to be known out there. We are working on the particulars, whether he know it or not, because he's a valuable brother, you know what I'm saying? We're going to be getting together. So I wanted it to be known. He's not moving by himself. He has a lot of force and power behind him. You got people that love him and want to protect him. I just want that to be known.
Appreciate that, Elder. Appreciate that, Brother Seville.
A great thing.
Thanks, Brother Seville, for that. We all feel that way. We're going to go ahead and take care of him up in Chicago, bro. When you coming out?
I'll probably be with him, brother.
You're going to have to be.
Right.
That's support. You know, because we plan on putting on a real decent event here in Chicago. And we have some powerful speakers on some other, and that's the only thing I'm really more concerned with, is to have people getting that information out there. I think that information is really what we need, because that miseducation of the Negro is running rampant in the community. And just like with what Reverend Ayers is going through up there in Benton Harbor, and that's because we don't have that education. And I agree with Brother Umar was saying. We were educating ourselves. But Brother Umar, what system would you go ahead and suggest would be an area we should start in to go ahead and start educating ourselves?
Honestly, we need to start with early childhood education, believe it or not. The babies and the preschoolers. One thing we have to understand about education is that education is primarily given through images and sound. Most conditioning is through images and sound. For example, one of the reasons why we've lost our teenage population is because they are totally being brainwashed by television and radio. Images and sound go directly to the unconscious. So whenever you want to condition the people for good or for bad, you have to control the images and you have to control the sound. And when you look at our preschool babies, the image diet that we feed them is one that is saturated with white superheroes. I often tell black parents that we should be careful about blaming white folk for teaching our kids to hate themselves and love Europeans, because from birth to age 5, up until kindergarten, the European really hasn't had any control over that young black child. But the parents have had the control. And when you look at the average daycare center, when you look at the average preschool, and when you look at the average room in our home for our children, you will see that nearly everything on the television, every DVD, every picture, every toy, and every book is of a European cartoon character or superhero. For example, I had an evaluation I was doing in Southwest Philadelphia 2 weeks ago. Beautiful black princess walked into my office to be tested. She was like second grade, 7 years old, and guess what she's holding in her hand? A book of a white Barbie with the blonde hair and the green eyes, and then I think she had the Barbie doll in her hand. So here is a milk chocolate, beautiful sister, full nose, full lips, high cheekbones, but she's walking around with the Barbie doll with blonde hair and blue eyes. So automatically, she's being conditioned to think that that Barbie doll
is more beautiful than her. And she's going to spend the greater part of her childhood years trying to look like something she is not. I can't blame the European for that. The school didn't give her the book, and the school didn't give her that Barbie doll. We are teaching our children to hate themselves.
Right. You brothers agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And then then our children grow up and want to be white.
Exactly.
The first thing they go out and get them a white woman if they get any money.
Exactly.
The
and
first
then the
thing
mother
they do.
Says, exactly. And then the mother says, I don't know why my son went out and married a white woman. Well, I say, well, let's look at that for a moment. Whose hair were you wearing on your head? Whose eyes were you putting inside of your eyes? Okay? So if your mother is trying to look like a white woman, then obviously the boy is going to make the conclusion that I don't want a bootleg version of beauty. I want the real thing. So he skips past his mother and goes straight to the white woman because after all, his entire life, he saw his mother trying to be the white woman. See, you can't lie to your children. You can't lie to your children. And we keep telling our children that we're so in love with our blackness and we're so in love with our Africanity and we're so in love with our history, but our children can see the hypocrisy because they have one question for us. If you are so in love with your culture and if you are so in love with your blackness and if you are so in love with the glorious history of Africa, then why in the hell don't we have a black-owned supermarket? Why in the hell don't we have a black-owned distribution company? Why in the hell don't we have a black-owned shipping line? If we are so in love with who we are, then why do we have no community infrastructure? This so-called Afrocentric conscious movement is a house of cards. All you have to do is blow, and it falls the hell down because it's built on hypocrisy. All talk and no institutions.
Thank you for that, brother. 314-915, your line is open. State your name, where you're calling from. You have a question or a comment?
Peace, Black African Power. This is Brother Son Nugent.
Oh.
What's up, fam?
How you doing now?
Hey, I'm doing good. I want to ask Brother Umar a question. Brother Umar, I heard you say on a different radio program that when a black man marries a white woman, he's making a political decision and letting the world know that he is seeking the white man's validation by marrying his queen. To send a message, a political message to the world. Now, I want to know what is the white woman's agenda? Does it go both ways? What is the white woman's agenda in marrying a black man?
Excellent question. First, as Dr. Nelly Fuller Jr. taught us in the code book, when a powerless person marries a powerful person, the powerful person rules the marriage, and the powerless person is still their slave. See, we fail to realize that just because a black man cohabitates with a white woman, he's not gaining anything because she has the backing of a white power structure, and he does not have the backing of any organized force. We have to understand this. And this is not to disrespect any black man who's married to a white woman, but we got to be honest, gentlemen. The only white women that black men are allowed to marry are the white women that other white men did not want. I want to make sure we understand this because some of us think that Kobe Bryant's wife and Michael Jordan's fiance and Charles Barkley's wife and Tim Duncan's wife, many of us think that these women were the cream of the crop amongst the European stock, and they were not. They are only with these rich black men because none of the rich white men wanted them. We have to be clear, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but black men with white wives tend to have the leftovers that white men don't want. we also have to understand that most white men will not remarry a white woman who was married to a black man. There's exceptions to every rule, and I know of some myself, but in the white community, it is taboo for most white men to marry a white woman after she has married a black man. So white women know that when they marry a black man, they are basically going black for good. Because if they ever come back to a European male, he's probably going to be of someone who's not of a certain financial or social status. So again, let's be clear now. The black man is not gaining. He's losing. The white woman is gaining because she's gaining his status and she's gaining his income. And the only thing she has to offer him is temporary probationary membership into her race, which will never become permanent. See, 98% of all interracial marriages are rich black men and poor white women. Let me say it again. 98% of all interracial marriages are black men with status and money who marry poor white women without status and money. This is not an insult to the white woman or the black man, but it is a political reality. These black men are being used and exploited by white women because they want acceptance into the white world. Show me who you love, and I will show you who you are.
I got a second question. One more question. Okay. Now, Brother Umar, I agree with everything you just said, brother. It's right on point. Now, I've seen some situations where you would see the dirt white trailer trash women. They would get with, they'll have sexual relations or they'll get in relationships with brothers who don't have much. I mean, they grew up poor and don't really have much. What is the, can you explain that? What is the thinking of that white woman?
Normally, there's two type of phenomenon going on there. First, let me deal with jungle fever. It is a cultural belief amongst white people that you have never really had sexual intercourse until you have had sexual intercourse with an African. In fact, this is not just a belief that's held amongst Europeans. Arabs and Orientals also have it. So white men, before they get married or while they're married, entertain a fantasy of having sex with a black woman. And white women entertain a fantasy of having sex with a black man. That's why for most of us who have ever went to a four-year traditional college where you stayed on campus, you will see that those white women were going crazy having sex with those black men. But what I want you to understand is after they graduate and after they put their suit on and after they get their hair cut and after they get their master's degree and when they decide that they're going to run for office or be a Fortune 500 CEO, or become a judge, you notice that they begin to do what? Part ways with the black man, part ways with the black woman, and they go back to their race. So number one, understand a lot of that is done out of lust. A lot of it is done out of neediness for a man because other white men don't want them. And the third factor, okay, the third factor, all right, is this right here. And the third factor speaks to the fact that some white people, out of rebellion for their own culture, will adapt aspects of African-American culture as a way to rebel against the white social order. But that rebellion against the white social order is temporary. How many of us see the young white girls smoking weed in the hood with the black guys, although they live up in the suburbs? How many of us see the white boys come down to the hood with their 75,000 Mercedes-Benzes with the big rims on them, with the Nikes and the Rockaway clothes and the gold chains, and they're hanging out with the brothers, but they sleep in the suburbs? And one of the mistakes that we make is when we see a white child or a white person who is going through a temporary stage of rebellion against their community. And keep in mind, it's temporary. It's a form of adolescence. It's temporary. But once they've been through that process, after 5 or 10 years, they go right back home to their race. Be clear about this. I want everybody to be clear about this. There's no white person on earth, nor has there been a white person in history who has ever, nor will ever, willingly give up their white privilege card to be equal with a black person. Never will any white person give up their white privilege card to be equal with a black person. This country is ruled by two fists. The fist of white racism, which keeps black people down, and the fist of white privilege, which keeps white people up.
There you go.
All right. That was well said, man. Thanks for answering my question, Brother Umar. Appreciate it, brother.
Not a
doing the great
I
work you've been doing.
That. Thank you.
Peace.
Thanks for calling in. 202-506. Your line is open. State your name, where you're calling from.
Peace. My name is Sister Fatima. Hello, Dr. Umar. How are you?
Peace, Queen. How's it going?
It's going. I really want you to address something right now. As an African American woman who loves, adores, and cherishes black men, I really want you to speak to the fact that there's a huge push for black women to either date white men or become lesbians right now.
Yes, it is.
First of all, lesbianism, indeed.
Lesbianism in the African American community has a history that is based on rejection that the black woman has felt by the treatment she's received from the black man, and pulling the black woman away from the black man by the white woman's lib movement. See, lesbianism in America was an outgrowth of the white woman's empowerment movement, and a lot of black sisters thinking that their gender took precedent over their race joined that particular movement. I see it on college campuses all the time, where the white women embrace the black women who feel victimized by their men. But the problem is that the sisters who allow themselves to be swept up by these white lesbian liberals fail to realize that at the end of the day, these liberals are still working in the interest of white supremacy. See, the first institution in any nation is the family. So if you want to destroy your nation, you have to attack the family. There can be no family if there is no cohesion between the male and the female. So they have the homosexual white male attacking the brother, pulling him away from his sister, and they have the lesbian white woman attacking the sister, pulling her away from her brother. But it is an attack on the family, and it really doesn't have as much to do with same gender sex as it looks like on the surface. It is an attempt to confuse black men and black women, to turn them permanently against one another, because if you and I can't sit still long enough to get along, we definitely ain't going to be able to get married and cohabitate and raise a family into this world. So ultimately, you are bringing about a state of genocide in the black community if you can successfully push homosexuality, lesbianism, and bisexuality, particularly amongst the brothers, because it is the bisexuality through which a lot of the AIDS infections amongst black women is taking place. Now, the hype, there's a lot of hype in the media right now for black women to date outside their race. In fact, a lot of famous black radio personalities and television personalities are advocating that black women date outside of their race. I believe Michael Bazin has spoke to this. I believe
he's the number one
rally has spoke to this. And let me tell you why they're doing it. A woman automatically becomes the cultural property of the race that she marries. Notice I didn't say the man that she marries, but the race that she marries. So if a black woman marries an Oriental, you now become the cultural property of Oriental people, and that is the culture that your children are going to be raised up into. If you marry a white man, even though that child will be considered an African in American society, you still become the cultural property of them. It is nothing more than a strategy of divide and conquer, separate and rule, that's being done to rid America of black people. And one thing we got to realize, a homosexual is still a racist. A lesbian is still a racist. And a lot of black people get this confused because they say, ain't we all minorities? a racial minority ain't got a damn thing to do with a sexual minority. But this is the confusion that they wreck upon us and having us think that we actually have loyalty with white homosexuals and white lesbians, because we keep on forgetting that white supremacy is white supremacy. And white supremacy does not discriminate based on sexual preference. It doesn't discriminate based on race. It doesn't discriminate based on income, skin complexion, or level of education. White supremacy means white on the top, be they gay or not, and black on the bottom, be they gay or not. So a white homosexual in a relationship with a white homosexual black male still sees him as a slave. And a white man in a relationship with a black woman sees her as a concubine. And I would caution my black sisters about running out there dating white men, because most white men, and I know sisters who've dated white men, they use them sexually and then they throw them away. They use them for their jungle fever, make them think they love them, make them perform all types of sexual acts that they would never expect from a white woman, and then they discard them. I have seen some sisters get their feelings hurt by thinking that a white man looked upon her as a queen. Black women have to understand that just because black men are in love with white women and are willing to marry them at the drop of a dime, the white man does not share the same sentiment.
May I make a quick comment? I will say this as far as homosexuality is related, be it the gay or the lesbian, they choose to live that life. I can't genetically change who I am as a black woman.
That's right. You can
wake up and change the mental illness of homosexual and lesbianism. They choose to live that way. People of color did not choose the skin we were born in. We were born the way we were born. And I don't agree with them piggybacking on our rights and saying we want certain rights and protections, because in the end, affirmative action is coming out to benefit the white woman and the gays. No longer are African-Americans, Latinos, and Asians benefiting from affirmative action. The gays and the white females are piggybacking on what we died for to get.
That's right.
And it really disgusts me. Not only does it disgust me, it angers me. And then I have a former friend. She dated interracially for a very long time. And we would argue about this. And she was like, well, you keep right on dealing with black men if you want to. And I went at it with her. And I said, you know what? You are going to be the sexual toilet for the white man. He does not respect you. And he does not love you. And now she's walking around mentally ill, nearly out of her mind because of all of the experiences she had dealing with white men. And now she's beginning to dabble in lesbianism.
That's right.
So no longer do we speak or even look at each other, because I couldn't have that in my realm. But seeing it for my own two eyes, I'm out here trying to warn a lot of sisters about this, and I just wanted you to speak to it. So thank you, Dr. Umar Johnson.
Thank you, Queen.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome.
I want to go ahead and go back and let everybody know this is Chef Rob Show. Brother Ed, you still there?
Still here. Hey, I'm just sitting back and enjoying. The doctor is laying it down. Matter of fact, I'm enjoying you so much, Doc. I don't know what to tell you, and I'm so excited because I know your my brother Paul Billings. He's a very close friend of mine also. And if you're going to be at the Michigan State, I'm definitely going to come there and be with you. That's my goal.
Well, I'll be looking forward to being in your presence, Elder. Hey. Love to drink from the feet and the wisdom of my elders.
Hey, believe me, this has really been an education for me tonight, and I have enjoyed every single minute. And any time that you find a brother who can elaborate just about on any level, hey, I got to take my hat off to you, brother. You've been tremendous tonight.
Thank you, Elder. Oh, man, whenever I get those type of words from an elder, I never forget it, brother. So that's in my heart for good.
Hey, I tell you, I'm excited, man, just to hear you, just go down through there, and people appreciate you. I can see that in you. And I'm planning on being in Chicago with you, too. I'm planning
right.
on because
right.
I'm originally from the west side of Chicago. I'm originally
right.
I used to play baseball in Garfield Park. And the Golden Dawn, I used to go over there and play ping pong and basketball.
Oh,
we're gonna
man.
Get to that.
Yes,
we're gonna
yes.
get Ricky, you still online?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Go ahead and let everybody know what's going on this summer, because we only got a few about 6 more minutes in the live show. If you guys don't mind, we'll go ahead and go to maybe like another 15, 20 more minutes of overtime and take a few more questions and call.
Not a problem.
Okay. Brother Richard, let everybody know what's going on in Chicago, because we want to have everybody at this powerful event this summer.
Well, I'd like to just, again, let all your listeners know that this June, from the 16th to the 21st, we will be having a Juneteenth Festival over in the Garfield Park, located at Madison and Central Park. It's going to be one of the largest festivals this summer, the five-day event. We have space for 300 vendors, for information vendors. We have space for food vendors, and we have space for merchandise vendors. It's going to have a carnival, three large stages, wonderful event. They can go to get more information at www.Juneteenth2011.com. Again, Juneteenth2011.com, and we meet every Saturday over at 100 North Central Park, over in Garfield Park at the Golden Dome that Reverend was just talking about, right at Washington and Central Park. So we look forward to having everyone to come out. And I really want to thank you, Chef, for allowing me the opportunity to talk about this. And we'll just sit back and listen to the rest of the show.
Okay. Let's take a quick break, and we're going to come back in the overtime. If you want to go ahead and call in, the call-in number is 347-215-7125. Again, that number is 347-215-7125. So,
I'm still trying. I'm still trying. What a confrontation this will be. Now look at me at a quarter to three. I wanna go home. That's where I should be. Don't know what to do or what I should say. Gotta make up my mind before night turns to day. The early, she told me, I'll be waiting for you, honey. I'll make something special for you. Now how am I gonna enter? I can't afford to wait her with lipstick stains. I've got to tiptoe. My double trouble is waiting. It's wrapped up in my bed. I'm tired, I'm sleepy. Can't take the noggin in my head. Double trouble is waiting. It's wrapped up in my bed. I'm so tired, I wanna go home. Now this is my day. Wonder if she's awake or asleep. If I know her well, she's somewhere taking a peek. What will my story be? This one better be good. Should I tell her I had a confrontation with Robin Hood? The early, she told me, I'll be waiting for you, honey. I'll make something special for you. Now how am I gonna enter? I can't afford to wait her with lipstick stains. I've got to tiptoe. Now double trouble is waiting. It's wrapped up in my bed. I'm tired, I'm sleepy. Can't think of nothing in my head. Double trouble is waiting. It's wrapped up in my bed. I'm so tired, I wanna go home. Now I'm worried for my life. It's going to fight. When I'm finally inside, will I still be alive? Now face behind the door. Gotta promise her a tour. The night is so cold, I can't take it no more, no. She told me, be early. I'll be waiting for you, honey. I'll make something special for you. Now how am I gonna venture? afford to wake her with lipstick stains. I've got to tiptoe. The double trouble is waiting. It's wrapped up in my bed. I'm so tired. I'm sleeping. Can't take the knocking.
All right, welcome back to the Chef Rob Show. We have another caller, 414-383. Your line is open. State your name, where you're calling from, question or comment, please.
Yes, Blessed Heart of Love to the Royal Family Black House of Israel. Yes, my brethren, blessed, you know, great, magnificent show you have on here tonight, Honorable Brother Chef. You know, my name is Honorable Prophet Mwambe Benito Acosta out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Hey, you going to be at our Juneteenth Festival, brother? You up there in Milwaukee. That's a stone throw away.
Huh? My lad, you're not lying, you know, and I'm going to really try my best to make it.
I'm on the line. Yeah,
as brother Umar, he's gonna be there, so I'm gonna really try my best to meet him before we meet in Jamaica, you know. Yes, I am of the order of the Bobo Shanti order, you know. We are part of the Ethiopia Africa Black International Congress Church of Salvation.
The roster from Milwaukee on here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, and it is an
honor
to be.
Hold on, brother. Everybody's line is open, so when you're having them other conversations, we can't hear what's going on, okay? All I ask is just nobody speak over nobody and show everybody respect and love. That's what I'm all about. Okay, go ahead. Continue, brother.
Yes, my brethren. Blessed love. You know, give thanks for that clearance, you know. It's a magnificent honor to be here amongst these very powerful brethren, you know, wonderful sister, you know, empresses, four wings of the earth. You know, it is a magnificent honor to be among such, you know, up-to-date minded black people at this hour, you know, because this is essential. We are under attack, and it is time now that we stand for it physically and spiritually. Yes, my brethren, you have to excuse me, you know, I'm battling over some laryngitis over here, you know, this cold and shoveling snow is getting to be enough, you know. I'm originally from the Virgin Islands.
Hey, let me help you with that. Let me help you with that, okay? Because I got roots in the Caribbean too, okay? Hey, one thing they used to give was just fresh ginger tea and some nice little chili soup. So
my lad, I'm working with the ginger tea right now. I got some lemongrass, ginger tea, garlic working right now on the stove, my lad. You know, so you know we're on top of it because as Bobo Shantis, you know, our responsibility really is to get back to the earth. You know. You know, because the Lord gave the earth and the fullness thereof, you know, the world and they that dwell therein, you know. So the balance is spiritual and material, you know. So because we're not perfect to that level as we were in the beginning, then in this times, you know, we're going to get lick up out here, you know, especially when we got to do these things like how the brother Umar is talking about, which is, you know, living under the law of these people here, you know. You're going to have to go through some things, you know, because you know, they're not gonna feed us the right things and make us take care of ourselves. You know, they're on an extermination program. You see, and this Ethiopia Africa Black International Congress is meant to bring us to remembrance of our godly self. You know, because we are gods and goddesses on this earth. You know, and this general of ours that has come in the form of three magnificent persons. You know. Because it's a spirit thing that we're fighting right here. It's spiritual iniquity and evil in high and low places.
Yeah.
Yes, my lord. You know, so it is very essential that we recognize, like my lord said, you know, because you see, we're kings. He's kings of kings and lord of lords. So we're all kings and we're all lords, you know, and we're all right in ourselves, gods and goddesses of the earth. You see, because it's written right there. It tells us right there in a good book. We just got to put it in perspective, you know, like the Honorable Brother was saying, too. You know, we got to know who we are. We got to know the problem so that when we apply our solution, it is effective. You know, so it's an honor to hear it. You know, the words that are coming out tonight, you know, the elders that have submitted to the word, you know, and have seen, because the elders, they know the way. You know, the young brothers and sisters, you know, we're the strength, you know. So putting it all together and in perspective, there's no way we cannot succeed in this life, you know, and win out from this mental slavery and break ourselves from this oppression. You know, so it's magnificent. I'm really glad that Brother Umar is coming to our inaugural Congress Day celebration this March 1st, you know, because in 1958, this man, Emmanuel Charles Edward, Emmanuel interpreted as the Reverend well knows is God with us, you know, and he's come here in this time to make us stand up as children as slaves. You know, stand up for our rights of freedom, redemption, and international repatriation, four wings of the earth. You know, we got to repatriate our continent. Like the brother said, it ain't something that has to be done physically. We can do it mentally. You know, once we do it mentally, it's all over, because then the unity is made. The